Blog Talk Radio.
So those faithless and perverse generation. Can you say faithless and what else? What makes a man get perverted but our faith? What's perverted our Christianity? Faithless.
Don't say that profess that God has given you power, love, and a sound mind, and your mind is not sound. You don't have power to overcome your present situation and circumstances.
Now the devil is always pushing. You can recognize the demons working because they always push to impetuous, immediate action. Don't think, do. And the devil says, if you don't do it now, you'll miss the opportunity. If you don't move now, if you don't sell now, if you don't jump now, it'll be gone.
And the kingdom of God is best expressed by authority and power to cast out devils.
Listen, dear friends. Don't forget that little word he said, seek ye first. Come on. That's the secret right there. Seek ye first. Seek ye first. Oh, I tell you, the average person said, seek me first. That's it. Seek me first. Put me first.
Well, anyone who opposes the kingdom of God and the casting out of devils. Because when we're of God's kingdom, our sole purpose is to destroy Satan's kingdom. Our sole purpose is to cast down Satan's kingdom.
I can tell you whether you won souls or not, whether you get your prayers answered, whether you're happy or not, whether you got a happy home or not, whether you're worth killing in the church or not. I can tell you, if you love your friends, and let me see how you start your day out. If you grab a cup of coffee and a newspaper and sit down for an hour and let the Bible go big and double, you're mixed up in worldliness.
The Word of God said, we're going over to the other side. And in the midst of the Word of God said, we are going over to the other side, the enemy showed up in the storm. And the first thing that the enemy did was challenge those who walk with Christ. Those who eat with him and slept with him and saw the miracle, the signs and the wonders done by him. The first thing that the enemy did was steal the word that they heard right out of their hearts and then allow doubt to rise up on the inside of them. And instead of believing what the word of God said, they said, Lord, we perish.
Reading the word that's going to give you faith, that isn't what he's talking about. It isn't just hearing the word that's going to give you faith. You've got to open your spiritual ear or eye as you hear or read the word and appropriate by faith. Make it yours.
That'll sober you up. That ought to melt your silly heart. I'm not interested in your feelings and your little silly sentimentality. I'm wondering about your love for Christ and compassion for others. Do you care? I'm asking you one question tonight. Do you love Jesus or do you love this stinking world?
But God wants us to be doers of the word and not hearers only. Deceiving ourselves. How many folks are deceived every single week? Going to hear what they call the word and it never once emboldens them or give them a desire or a passion to do the works of Christ.
We want just a bunch of sickly sentimentality and we want to just fix up sort of a hiding place and a loophole for sinners to say, well, if that old cuss made it in, I can make it in myself.
The kingdom is within you. And the only kingdom that this world is going to understand until the king comes is what they see in us. Because now we are the only creatures that have the ability to walk in darkness and to walk in light.
How God's people glory! Shalom, 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 saints of the Most High. I pray that you're all doing well this evening on this first day as we come to a close here in Tennessee and wherever you are in this world, that you had a good day. This is Elder Douglas Fechter hosting tonight's segment of the Brothers segment of Blog Talk Radio. Somebody give me a radio check. Thank you, Brother Ugly. Thank you, Sister Brittany. Okay, apparently it's coming in well. I'm grateful for that.
It's been a pretty good string of success for these things coming in good. Bless you, Brother Willie. Good to see you on here. Sister Sheila. Bless you, Diane. Bless you, Lisa. And all the others that are coming into the room. Sister Carla, Sister Tara. Blessings to y'all. Oh, boy. I don't know if it's the change in the time of the year or what, but, boy, I just get wore out quickly now. Who knows? Great for the sunshine, grateful for the warm-up in the weather. This winter stuff gets old if you live in this part of the country. Hope you're still feasting on the word from yesterday. A lot about judgment was spoken yesterday by Pastor Dow. You know, judging others and more so judging yourself, taking a look at yourself, where you're at, measuring yourself in light of the word, always edifying, always the things that Israel needs to go on to perfection. Without a preacher, how can they hear, right? Faith cometh by hearing. So we're grateful and thankful for Yah's supplied us with pastors according to his heart. I didn't give Brother Shane the topic for tonight. I was kind of going back and forth, but I decided to go the way that I had been kind of pushing for a while. And we're going to be talking about John chapter 8 and the account of the woman caught in the act of adultery. And it's kind of strange how I all came to this, actually talking about this, is for on and off for many, many many months, you know, I pick it up, put it down, just studying about, you know, differences, principles in the Bible about adultery and fornication and, you know, how they're interwoven through the text and through the stories and the implications behind them. And about a month ago, I got interested in, again, looking back at some stuff as I was reading, and then things pop in my mind. I go back and put it in the study again, and then I actually had addressed three incidences in different accounts of adultery in the Bible, and I submitted them to Pastor Dow and for him to look at and give me his thoughts on them. I haven't heard back, but that's, you know, to be expected how busy he is. So. And then in the past 4 weeks, I can't even tell you how many times the this story has come up. It even floored me. I mean, what's the irony? And, you know, not only did I hear brothers speaking about it, which is, I mean, in all the topics in the Word to speak about, you know, they're openly talking about their thoughts on this particular passage, seen it popping up in YouTube streams, people just mentioning it in passing. I mean, even yesterday, Pastor Dell mentioned it and during the preaching. So it was like, wow, okay, so I don't know what this is supposed to mean, because I don't consider myself any type of genius in anything. I just want to bring the word as much integrity and honor to it as, you know, when y'all put it out there. That is my hope, and never to ever cause anybody to, you know, be confused or confounded by any study that I do. So, but anyway, this study tonight is not so much to do with the merits of the story as if it has to do with, you know, the forgiveness part and the, but that wasn't my angle to begin with. What it was is there's so much debate that has surrounded this chapter or this passage for many years, many centuries, I should say. And honestly, I'd never looked into it myself, what all the hoopla is about, what all the to-do is about. So when I started actually looking into it, I was amazed. But that's, I'm going to kind of go over that tonight, and hopefully that, Brother August says, well, I opened my e-sword and opened up to John chapter 8. Well, praise Yah, oh, glory to the King. And thank you, Brother Ugly, for always being there, for posting for the saints in the chat room. Appreciate it. But with that, again, we're going to concentrate on the authenticity, but we're going to take a different route in doing it. So I hope it's edifying. I hope we can all learn something from it. I definitely did. All right, there has been centuries of debate concerning the authenticity of John chapter 8, verses 1 through 11, the account of the woman who was caught in the act of adultery. You're going to find out that other people cite John chapter 7, verse 53, and then 8, 1 through 11, because they include the last verse in John chapter 7 for whatever reason. Many claim that it was not a part of the original Greek manuscripts and cannot be found in the earliest codex. A codex is just simply the fancy word for the ancient manuscripts. Some claim that it was nothing more than an interpolation, which is a mixture of, they take different stories and different bits from different places and they pull them together to make one account and then they insert them someplace into a text. And that there is simply too much history that doesn't give this account much footing. But on the other side of things, there are many that believe that they have proven that the account is in fact authentic, and they will also provide proof of their claims. And in all these ongoing debates, there is rarely, if ever, any introduction of the Torah and the Tanakh as to use as a measuring stick as to the validity of the story of the woman caught in the act of adultery. Most of the argument for or against the account stems from historical record and a faith-based mindset, meaning more of a Christian attitude. We will not only be testing this account in light of Torah as to its authenticity, but we also be dispelling some misguided notions and possibly enforcing some of the more sensible narratives of the woman caught in the act of adultery. And in addition, and to further support the outcome of this study, we will also include verses following the conclusion of the direct matter of the woman, meaning verses beyond verse 11, as the verses that follow will in a major way reinforce the whole motive behind the action of a few men and bring their deeds to light. And looking at this whole account, when viewed in content and context, as you have to do, we will see it is more to do with witness and righteous judgment than it has to do really with the, most people put the point on is the adultery. And if you ever do go decide to do this study for yourself, there's a lot out there, YouTube, you know, John chapter 8, verse 11, the woman caught, you know, you just have to type in verses 1 through 11, you'll get just a nonstop flood of videos coming up. And you hear a word like pericope de adulterae, which is, they use that word a lot, which is just a Greek term for the word pericope, or pericope just means passage or selection, and de adulterae is simply adultery, so the passage of adultery. But they really get deep into some of these terms. But again, they really, historically, when you follow people doing this, they never invoke and never provide evidence based for or against this account on the Torah and the Tanakh. They always use historical manuscripts. If you ever do look into this, you're going to find out that this particular account, if you use 100% of the manuscripts that are out there and pull them all together, and if this account is actually found in 85% of them. But the problem lies in the fact that they say it's not in the earliest accounts and it doesn't come into play until somewhere in the 4th century. And so what people have done is they've taken this and debated back and forth on that merit plus the faith merit, you know, that Jesus forgave adultery, so it has to be for this time, it fits the narrative type of thing. Or, again, the historical account. But we're going to use the Torah and Tanakh to try to maybe dispel or change the thought as to what we commonly believe, that if we read it for ourselves, that if we've examined in light of Torah, what it may or may not be saying. And yeah, again, Pastor mentioned it yesterday, and his words were that it was just a great big setup. I mean, you'll see the men involved in this, the scribes and Pharisees, to them, you know, the whole story was behind that was just a huge setup. And I believe that's pretty much nails it, but I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. So what we're going to do is read through the whole thing first, then we're going to go down and break it down bit by bit. And we're going to start, of course, John chapter 8, verses 1, Brother Ugly, all the way through verse 18. Because, again, it's content and context, and they have to flow together. And people typically would stop at the 11 verses. You find out, though, that they all do pull together in unity. They all reflect and back each other up. All right, Jesus went in unto the Mount of Olives, starting in verse 1, and early in the morning he came in again into the temple. So the opening scene of this, as if we were reading it, what it would be saying is that it was very early in the morning. Jesus came again in the temple, as it was his custom to do, and all the people came unto him, and he sat down and taught them. Now remember that, if you can, for later in the study, that it was early in the morning, and he came and again came. He was in the temple. That was the setting, so that's where he was. And the scribes and Pharisees brought unto, and he sat down and taught them. So there's people already there. When he went in there and he sat down, he was sitting, and he began to teach them. And in the midst of this, the scribes and Pharisees brought unto him a woman taken, which is caught in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, they say unto him, Master, this woman was taken in adultery in the very act. And again, all this will be coming from the King James Version. Now Moses in the law commandeth that such should be stoned, but what sayest thou? This they said, tempting him, that they might have to accuse him. But Jesus stooped down and with his finger wrote on the ground, as though he heard them not. And those words are italicized, so they were added in there. So it should be, but Jesus stooped down with his finger wrote on the ground. So when they continued asking him, he lifted up himself and said unto them, he that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her. And again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. And they which heard it, being convicted by their own conscience, went out one by one, beginning at the eldest, even to the last, and Jesus was left alone, and the woman standing in the midst. When Jesus had lifted himself up and saw none but the woman, he said unto her, Woman, where are thine accusers? Hath no man condemned thee? And she said, No man, Master. And Jesus said unto her, Neither do I condemn thee. Go and sin no more. Then Jesus spake again unto them, saying, I am the light of the world. He that followeth me and shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of light. The Pharisees therefore said unto him, Thou bearest record of thyself, thy record is not true. Jesus said and answered unto them, Though I bear record of myself, yet my record is true, for I know whence I came and whither I go. But you cannot tell whence I came and whither I go. You judge after the flesh, I judge no man. And yet if I judge, my judgment is true. For I am not alone, but I am Yahweh, I am the Father that sent me. It is also written in your law that the testimony of two men is true. I am the one that bear witness of myself, and the Father that sent me beareth witness of me. Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to break this down little by little, and we're going to start with the first five verses, okay? In the first five verses, we find Yahshua in the temple teaching the people. In the midst of his teaching, there enters a group of scribes and Pharisees. Of course, these are men of high esteem and ranking in the ecclesiastical authority of Israel, who had in their possession a woman who supposedly was caught committing adultery in the very act of the deed. This woman is placed on complete display, right? Just put it right there, right in the wide open with all present looking at her. These scribes and Pharisees then demand an answer from Jesus as to the context. Demand an answer from Jesus as to the context of the Torah pertaining to the stoning of those caught in, because they want to know but that which is written, how Jesus is going to respond to that when they ask the question. Obviously, this was set up from the beginning, a well-laid-out plan, for as we read, the whole motivation behind this plan was to tempt Yahshua. So that was their motivation. So again, rereading verses, John 8, verses 1 through 5, to get a refresher. So Jesus went to the Mount of Olives, as we heard. It was early in the morning, he came again to the temple. All the people came unto him, and he sat down and taught them. And the scribes and Pharisees brought in him a woman taken or caught in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, they said, the Master, this woman was taken and in adultery in the very act. So they're highlighting all the specifics of what's going on here. Now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be shown. What such should be stoned, but what sayest thou? Of course, these men, this group of scribes and Pharisees had judged already, according to the law of Moses, set themselves in a place of judgment as they were supposedly witnesses to this crime and condemned this woman to death by stoning, as saith the law of Moses. So they're all ready for it. They came there with this attitude. They came there with this proof, and they had already judged. And they just wanted to see what Jesus was going to say. All right? All right, so there's an argument that stems from this, these first five verses, in fact, from the whole account that, and it's brought up so many times. I mean, I asked myself when I read this in the past. So according to the Torah, Leviticus 20, verse 10, says, and the man that committeth adultery with another man's wife, even he that committeth adultery with his neighbor's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. So there's always been an argument this story can't have authenticity because where was the man? Why wasn't, if they caught the woman in the very act of adultery, it stands to reason that she was with the man, would it not? I mean, it just makes sense. So why wasn't he here? And there's been a plethora of different ideas as to why, but the fact of the matter, he wasn't present. Well, after thinking about this and hearing a lot of the different arguments against the possible authenticity about this, because that you have to present the man also with the woman, and they're both going to be stoned, is the fact that nobody's probably ever considered this, that the man may have not been of the nation of Israel. You know, because this is a woman who's obviously an Israelite. She's an Israelitess woman, because because the law does apply to her. That's why they brought her. But if she had actually gone and laid with a man of another nation, say a Roman soldier, a Roman citizen, our laws don't apply to those of other nations. So it stands to reason that the only one that would be brought would be this woman. Because again, remember, the details say that she was caught in the very act. So the question again that goes back to dispel the authority of this whole passage is that the man was never brought there. And as we know, we just read Leviticus 20:10 demands that they both be there. So a very good possibility is, again, like I said, she may have simply been sleeping, if in fact, you know, this is the case, that she could have just been sleeping and had laid with a man of another nation. Again, he's not subject to our laws. If it had been a Roman, he would have been subject to the laws of them nations. And if Israel tried to press the laws of Yah onto that of another nation, then they would have had to deal with the Roman government. So you can't use that argument to say this dispels the entire account, because it doesn't work, because it is possible and very possible that she simply was with somebody from another nation. All right? So that's my version of how to dispel at least that part of the argument. And, you know, in the Bible they call it committing harlotry, whoredoms. They go to people of other nations, all right? All right, so next let's deal with the temptation placed before Messiah and the nature or the thought behind what the enticement to seemingly circumvent conditions already in place. It's all too apparent that the form of temptation was to in some way, shape, or form circumvent or avoid addressing the law of Moses directly, consenting to its mandate of stoning for adultery. Yahshua was often tempted with questions introduced by the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees in order to smear his credibility among the people and give occasion to charge him with blasphemy as to who he said he was. And just to be clear, there is no actual way of knowing what this temptation was and their hopeful outcome in order to charge Jesus with denying the law of Moses. But we have many examples of the motivation behind temptations found in other places in the Word, so a narrative is much easier to be formulated. And again, I'm reading from my notes, so I'm sorry if it sounds confusing, but basically that Their whole mission, the scribes, the Pharisees, and the Sadducees, was to destroy Jesus' credibility, because they had a great fear because they saw the people going to him and acknowledge him as the Messiah, the one that the prophets had spoken about, that he was there, and they were afraid of losing their status, their place, and their nation. So Jesus' presence was a constant threat to them. And they had a push and a motivation to discredit who he was and trap him time and time again, to trap him and to snare him and then show all the other people around that he can't be who he says he is. And it's nothing different in this account. So John chapter 8, verse 6. This they said, tempting him that they might have to accuse him. So the reason behind the temptation for wanting to tempt him so they might actually accuse him, which is to tempt is to entice or to scrutinize or to test him. So they wanted to entice Jesus that they might to accuse him, which is to charge with some offense. So they wanted to trick him, to deceive him, to entice him, to go against whatever it is that they were looking for, that they might actually charge him with some offense and show that he was truly an imposter and who that he was and said that he was. But Jesus stooped down with his finger, wrote on the ground, right? So he ignored them and he began writing when they asked him this question. Now, there are many that argue that the temptation that the scribes and Pharisees placed before Jesus was one in choosing to obey Rome's laws over the Torah, as Rome's laws would not have allowed those whom it ruled over to dole out death sentence on their own accords. But just looking into some accounts in the same Bible, this argument is proof flawed and worthless. And we're going to read through them. So again, if you ever do the study in this, that's one of the arguments that that the story is flawed, that it's not actually authentic because, I'm kind of off track. You're looking at one of my notes. Is that the temptation to trick Jesus was to either obey Roman law or stick to Israel's laws. That's what it was, to see if he would actually be joined to Caesar or be joined to Israel and possibly face some type of punishment. But, of course, when you read to the word, you can find out that whoever invented that thought is totally oblivious to the other counts that are written in the Word. So if we look at John chapter 10, verses 31 and 33, and we're just going to read through a few of them to show that stoning was not only acceptable, but it happened a great deal of times in the Word, all right, in the Renewed Covenant. So John chapter 10, verse 31 to 33. Then the Jews took up stones again to stone him. Okay, so if it wasn't possible, why were they even picking up rocks, right? And Jesus answered them, "Many good works have I showed you from my Father. For which of those works do you stone me?" So they were right in the middle of wanting to stone me. They all had stones. If the Roman government was a threat at all, do you think they would even have a stone in their hand? The Jews answered him, saying, "For good work we stone thee not, but for blasphemy, because thou, being a man, makest thyself Yah." There is every indication here that stoning was indeed something allowed and executed, as had Israel not had the place to do so under the umbrella of Rome, then certainly it stands to reason that there would not been this threat made against Messiah, as it would not have been allowed to be carried out. I'm reading from my notes again, but that's exactly what's going on here. So we're already dispelling this crazy thought that they inject there, that Jesus' temptation was, you know, to accept Rome or to accept the nation of Israel, depending on who he's standing on. Because they could, the first scribe, say, if Jesus would have accepted Caesar and would have backed down, they would have said, "See, look, he can't be part of the people. He can't be part of the nation of Israel. He can't be who he says he is because he's bowing the knee to Caesar. How can he be the king of Israel?" So, again, Acts chapter 7, verses 55 and through 60. And I'm not going to go through and read it all, but again, we have the account of Stephen in there, right? Stephen, you go back and read it yourself. But in verse 58, it said, "And they cast him out of the city, and they stoned him." Again, this happened in the city of Jerusalem. If you go back and start in Acts chapter 7, at the very beginning, you're going to find out that Stephen and the elders and all the people were sitting there in Jerusalem when Stephen was rebuking the shit out of them, right? When he was laying it down, and they got upset as they all could be, and they grabbed up stones to stone him. Again, another perfect example that stoning was actually allowed by the Roman government for the nation of Israel. They could enact their laws and perform them without being hindered by the Roman government. And then Acts chapter 14, verse 19, Acts 14, 19, you can write these things down if you want. "And there came hither certain Jews from Antioch and Iconium, who persuaded the people, having stoned Paul, drew him out of the city, supposing he had been dead." So in Antioch and Iconium, these Yehudims came from there, and they got all the people together, and they all lobbed stones at Paul. So this is the third piece of evidence that shows, again, that this idea that they were tempting him to obey Roman law, the laws of the Most High, is totally ridiculous and absurd. So, and then also Acts chapter 8, verses 1 through 3, you can go back and read them, but it further proves that that the Apostle Saul, later whose name was changed to Paul, was actually consenting. He was a religious figure, authority figure at that time, as we all well know Paul's history, and he was actually at Jerusalem when he was actually consenting and gave his consent to the stoning death of Stephen. So I think this pretty much dispels that silly argument that what that particular temptation might have been. All right, was a temptation, was it a test to see if Jesus would simply forgive the woman or provide another course of action disregarding the law of Moses, proving to the religious order of the day that this man Jesus was indeed a blasphemer and worthy of death? So again, it was another temptation to see if he would just totally sidestep Torah, because remember, he said that he made himself equal with Yah. That's what, and we're going to read that here. And every indication, and many times he forgave sin through there, and they always accused him of blasphemy because he set himself in the same position as the Most High, because only Yah could forgive sin. And so they're dealing with the same aspect here. Is he just going to totally circumvent, look away from what the law of Moses was concerning stoning for the adulterous act, and just simply right there say, nope, she's released like everybody else, be forgiven, and she can go on their way? Well, they're going to all of a sudden accuse him that, no, you are not, you can't be of Israel because you're not upholding Torah. All right, let's see, John chapter 5, verse 18. Therefore, the Yehudim sought the more to kill him because he had not only broken the Sabbath, but he said also that Yah was his father, making himself equal with Yah. So we have an instance here where he's actually taken the feast day, the Holy Shabbat, and they've accused him in John chapter 5 of breaking it, always continually trying to destroy his credibility from the beginning of his ministry till he was put on the tree, the whole time doing whatever he could to make him less in the eyes of the people. And this temptation in the temple with this woman was no different. So Mark chapter 2, verses 3 through 10, another example of their motivation, the scribes and the Pharisees, as it had to do with the temptation. They had a pattern of these things. Okay, and they come unto him, bringing one sick of palsy, which was born of four. And when they could not come nigh unto him for the press, they uncovered the roof where he was. And when they had broken it up, they let down the bed wherein the sick of palsy lay. When Jesus saw their faith, he said unto the sick of palsy, son, thy sins be forgiven thee. But there were certain again of the scribes sitting there, you know, the religious rite, and reasoning in their hearts, that why does this man thus speak blasphemies? Who can forgive sins but Yah? So that you can see by the context here and everything that we read so far that they had a deep ire, deep hatred, a deep bitterness towards Jesus, and they were doing everything they possibly could to entrap him. And of course, it was no different with this scenario, this situation we have in front of us in the temple as they brought this woman. All right, so I think that's enough. I had another one, Luke 7, 44 through 49, which just basically says the same thing, that he forgave somebody for their sins, and then they question, well, who else can forgive sin? So was that part of the temptation? I don't know. There's no way of knowing, but I'm just putting some out there as possibilities to consider because there's a pattern to it. All right, we're going to move on to casting a stone and the writing on the ground. And that happened in John chapter 8, verses 6 through 8. Them three verses contain the description of what happened with when Yahshua began writing on the ground, and the temptation to, or the enticement to cast the stone. All right, now I'm just going to reread it again so we can break it down. So verse 6. This they said, tempting him, that they might have to accuse him. But Jesus stooped down and with his finger wrote on the ground, and italicized as though they heard him not. So He was sitting down. He stooped forward. He began writing on the ground as they were talking to him. So when they continued asking him, all right, so they continued asking him, he lifted up himself and said unto them, "He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her." Now, when you break down the words "let him" and "first cast," you know what's funny when I was looking this up is the fact that in different my different apps, downloads, and on my eSword, that in some of them, when you look at the word "let him," it's the Greek 906, which means to throw, and then "cast" is the Greek 906 throw. And then other publications, Bibles, they actually take the Greek 44:13 and they combine "let him" instead of, what do they do? Okay, "let him first." They combine them three, "let him first" together under Greek 44:13 instead of other ones that said just "let him," which is a Greek 906, and then "first cast," which is another Greek 906, so they divide it up. I have no reason why. I mean, they're trying to change the meaning, but if you go from the two that says Greek 906, and to "let him," and then "first cast" Greek 9. I know I'm not trying to be confusing, but because I can see it in front of me, so I hope you're following me. But it basically means to throw first, throw a stone first. All right. So he that is without sin among you, you go ahead and throw first, and you throw the first stone. That's what it says if you look at it in the Greek 906 sense, if that makes sense. And I don't think either one of them really mess up the meaning too much. So we have, it seems, a small problem as this verse, as it pertains to having to be without sin and casting a stone, is not something that is seen in the Torah or elsewhere in the whole of the Bible, meaning that what I'm going to talk about here is that you're never going to see anywhere in the world, as least as I can tell, and somebody correct me, I'm sure somebody may, there's a lot more learned people than I'll ever be, but if anybody's ever come across anywhere where it talks about, let's say capital punishment or any punishment, transgression that's worthy of death in the word, right? Anywhere, is there a stipulation that you can't be casting a stone if you're in sin? Isn't anywhere. But all of a sudden we find it in here, in this verse, saying, "He that is without sin among you," supposedly the words of Messiah. But it raises issues because it's not reflecting on Torah. See, when Torah, whenever there was a transgression and people were judged as being punished by death, by stoning, you're going to find out that it was either the whole entire congregation, first the witnesses and then the whole entire congregation, or sometimes it was just the men that was doing it, depending on what the infraction was or what the transgression was. But here in this verse we got Jesus, they say that Jesus said that let him that is without sin among you cast the first stone. And I'm just saying and showing you that that's not Torah. It's not there. It doesn't contain that stipulation. It doesn't change. There's not a discrimination set up there that says, well, you know, and who's going to admit they're in sin, right? Okay, so there's got to be something more to this going on than what, if it is in fact a credible source, there's got to be something beyond what we're seeing just here on the page in the natural. I'm just bringing up, showing you something that isn't reflective of Torah. It isn't a stipulation of Torah. All right. So John 8:8, and again he stooped down and he wrote on the ground. So we have Jesus stooping down, writing once, and they continue asking him. And he lifts himself up and he makes the statement, "He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her." And then he stoops down again and he writes again. So he performs his writing task twice. Not once, but twice. He was doing it once. He sat up and then he stooped down again. And he wrote something, so he wrote twice. I don't know if he continued to thought or whatever. And that's been the subject of much theory, much guesswork, if I can use that word, what he wrote. It could be, if in fact the story is credible and it's factual, it could be just about anything, right? It really could be. But what I did and what aspect that I looked into when I was doing this, and for whatever it value it has, is it makes it, the whole account points you to the fact that it was with his finger that he wrote on the ground. He didn't take a stick, he didn't take any, but he wrote on his finger. And if we look historically and we look at the implications by, you know, because Jesus was Yah manifest in the flesh, we know that this means something. So that might be an indication of where what the writing could have possibly been. That's my thing. But again, Exodus 31:18. And he gave unto Moses, when he had made an end of communing with him upon Mount Sinai, two tables of testimony, two tables of stone written with the finger of Yah. The finger of Yah translates and shows that it's with the divine authority of the Most High. And because of this, he's sending a message to the scribes and Pharisees that it's just another blot in their face, because they've already accused him of, him being an imposter, being a fake, being a phony, being an antichrist, any other word that I can come up with, that he made himself equal with Yah, and they call it blasphemy. So why not rub it in a little bit, and why not use the finger? Because obviously we're all well-versed in what the finger meant. Maybe there was a subliminal thing there that when he did it, it sent him a message. Again, Exodus 31:18 talks about the two tables of stone written with the finger of Yah. And then you can look in Deuteronomy chapter 9, verses 7 through 10, and it speaks about the same thing. Same exact thing. So I don't know if that's what it is or not, but it was something that, it was the first time that I've ever, in all the accounts that I've ever written, it just really, truly jumped out to me. So maybe it does give direction, if the story's credible, what was written on the ground. That might have been either two of the Ten Commandments. It may have been other things, but my sincere belief is that Jesus purposely chose this course to further demonstrate who he was and by what authority he did the things he did, and also to further infuriate and stir up the scribes and Pharisees. The finger of Yahweh represents his divine authority. We know Yahweh placed his personalized demands for Israel by inscribing his Ten Commandments on two tables of stone, and we can read in the Gospels of how Yahshua said that he cast out spirits by the finger of Yah, again subscribing to the divine authority of the Creator. And of course, the topic of discussion, a myriad of opinions of what it was that Jesus wrote on the ground, and of course, there is just no way to know. I have my own ideas, but they are just that, my own ideas. If the reason for writing with his finger was to bring to mind the two tablets of stone on which Yahweh inscribed the Ten Commandments, then it would stand to reason that it may have been two of the Ten Commandments, which Yahshua wrote upon the ground. It also may have been, I was looking over some other things, Deuteronomy 6:16, you shall not tempt Yahweh the Elohim. That had nothing to do with the finger, but it could have been something Jesus wrote, or it could have been Exodus 23 verses 1 and 2 about raising a false report, but who can really know? And you can guess, if I was to guess two of the Ten Commandments, one would have been, of course, the ninth one, don't bear false witness, and the other one would be, thou shalt not commit adultery, and that might be reflective, as some people have said, that the scribes and Pharisees, the reason we'll find out is they went out by one is that it reflects in the story. As some people say that they were guilty of being the woman with one time as well. But I don't think that's the case. I think I don't think that was the case at all. All right, no accusers to bear witness against the crime of adultery. And we're going to take a look at this aspect. So John chapter 8, verses 9 and 10. And this here is very significant, because the law is definitely definitive about witnesses being involved. And they which heard it being convicted by their own conscience. So we have the story again in John 8, and they ask Jesus, you know, they tempt him, so they want to accuse him, and they use the law of Moses, because that's a situation for stoning, the act of adultery. He writes on the ground twice, and then they which heard it hurt, meaning that he that was without sin first cast the stone, right? That's what they heard. That's what they heard him say. And so they which heard it, being convicted by their own conscience, went out one by one, beginning at the eldest, even unto the last, and Jesus was left alone and the woman standing in the midst. What they heard was the word spoken of by Messiah, that he that is without sin, let him first cast a stone. Quite obviously, they were all in sin, as their departure made manifest this very thing. We don't know what that sin is, but again, it begs the question, what were those sins? Again, we can't answer that. Were those sins the things that Jesus wrote on the ground with his finger? Did he remind them of the things written in the law of Moses, the laws which they zealously supported to the point of killing those who they labeled as lawbreakers? What Jesus wrote telegraph to them that he knew exactly what they had in their hearts and was exposing their wickedness? I actually believe that's a good possibility, because we know clearly that Yah judges the thoughts and intents of a man's heart. So he may have actually been writing something in there with his finger that reflected the wickedness going on in their own heart. Again, there's no way to prove it. Again, we're testing the credibility of the authenticity of John chapter 8, the woman caught in the act of adultery, as it's based on Torah. So I have to bring up a lot of Torah and a lot of illustrations to show where it may fit or where it may not fit. Now we're on the part of the accusers, which we're going to find out that it actually means witnesses. So again, verse 10, when Jesus had lifted up himself and saw none but the woman, he said unto her, Woman, where are thine accusers? Hath no man condemned me? Now the Torah requires that there must be two valid witnesses in which to carry out a sentence of punishment for sins which call for the death penalty, such as adultery. Out of the mouth of one witness, nothing shall be done. Could it have been the case that Jesus was indirectly exposing that these men who brought this woman caught in the act of adultery, that they were actually false witnesses, that they witnessed nothing at all, and were seeking judgment based on false allegations? The Torah provides severe punishment against any which rise up against their brother or sister bearing false witness, as the punishment that was intended to the one accused would be executed upon the false witness. Is this the reason why those men departed? Because Jesus might have just wrote on there that about not bear false witness, or that if you do bear false witness, this is going to be the end of you for doing it. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 6 and 7. We're going to read it. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 6 and 7. At the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses shall he that is worthy of death be put to death. So we already know it's out of the two witnesses or three death. And put to death, obviously adultery is being stoned to death. So this definitely has to have two witnesses or three witnesses. But at the mouth of one witness, he shall not be put to death. The hands of the witness shall be first upon him to put him to death, and afterwards the hands of the people. So shalt thou put away the evil from among you. So the whole purpose and idea was to actually stone them to death, so this wicked way, this abomination, this vile thing would be eliminated from the midst of the people, because this kind of stuff can spread, right? And it's an affront to the Most High. Obviously, as they all that left there out and made no witnesses. But think about the implications here, as they have to do with the possible stoning of the woman taken in adultery. What are the implications? If indeed the allegations were false, and had Jesus agreed with the scribes and Pharisees that she had to be stoned to death under the law of Moses, then according to the commandment, after the witness first cast stones, it would have then fallen on the people, including Yahshua, to cast stones at her. Would this then have made them all guilty of having her blood on their hands, as they were showing that they were consenting unto her death? So you had a group of people that brought her in, they lied on her, and if Jesus would have fell for this, obviously he would have been implicated in consenting unto her death. He would have, too, by Torah, had to pick up a stone and cast it. But of course, being Messiah, already knowing what that was in the heart of these scribes and Pharisees and religious rulers, and being able to discern all men's hearts, he already knew what was going on when they showed up. Again, Exodus chapter 20, verse 16. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Exodus 23, verses 1 and 2. That's the one I was wanting to get to. Exodus 23, verse 1 and 2. So you tie this back into this whole story, and you can see these men standing here, standing there with that woman. They're saying she's, we're in the midst of them. And then you have a better understanding of what the possibility, if the story is authentic, what could have been behind it, and why they left. Thou shalt not raise a false report. Put not thine hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. Thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil. Neither shalt thou speak in a cause to decline after many to wrest judgment. So even based on them two verses, I mean, that's enough information right there to say that this is a big no-no, right? Absolutely big no-no. You shall not raise a false report. Put not thine hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. And if you look at it and understand these men's reasoning, these scribes and Pharisees, I would almost say that they were unrighteous witnesses. Again, the whole thing was a setup, right? It was a con job, and Jesus caught on to it right away. I just let the cat. I actually believe that I believe the thing is more to do with being authentic than a fiction. But anyway, Deuteronomy 19, verses 16 through 21. Deuteronomy 19, 16 through 21. And it says, if a false witness rise up against any man to testify against him that which is wrong, okay, so that there's a wrong, and there's something that is definitely needs addressing, needs the attention brought to it, then both the men between whom the controversy is shall stand before Yahweh, before the priests and the judges, which shall be in the... So we got this whole thing, and they're going before not only the authority on this earth, but the divine authority, which is in Shemaim, right? So this is no light matter. And the judges shall make diligent inquisition, and behold, if the witness be a false witness, and they have testified falsely against his brother, oh, here it comes, retribution, right? Then you shall do unto him as he had thought to have done unto his brother. So thou shalt put away evil from among you. And those which remain shall hear and fear, and shall henceforth commit no more any such evil among you. And thine eyes shall not pity, but life shall go for life. I mean, it doesn't matter who it was. It could have been the most loved person in the entire tribe, right? But if they're going to bring a false witness, spirit going to jump on them, and they're going to try to press something against their brother, or sister against sister, or brother against sister, whatever the case. And after the inquisition, after questioning, they find out that the one person falsified the whole thing. Then whatever they were demanding in their request against this other person, they might have been making something up to put him to death, so his death would cover up some wickedness they were doing. I mean, there's all kind of reasons for it, but again, so the Most High had Moses implement this law, these ordinances, so people wouldn't get away with that false accusation. I mean, you can, shit, no farther look than the CPS. They do it all day long. I mean, they can come and take your children for any reason, and you don't have the right to face your accuser, but here you do. And thy eye shall not pity, but life shall go for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. I'll say back to verse 10, John chapter 8, verse 10. When Jesus had lifted up himself and saw none but the woman, he said unto her, Woman, where are thine accusers? Hath no man condemned me? So on verse 10, we have a situation. They've all fled, right, for whatever reason. They all got the hell beat out of them in their hearts and their minds. They got convicted, as the word said, and they bailed, right? So nobody was there. It was just Yahshua standing there, as the story goes, as the passage goes, the account. And the people that he had taught in the temple obviously were still around, because it doesn't say they left. I mean, this is excitement, man. You think any people are going to turn around and walk the other way? No, people like new things. They like excitement. They want to see when there's confrontation going on. They come in droves, so all we know is that the religious leaders, they all left, but it doesn't say anything about anybody else. So when he went in the temple that morning, the people were already there, and they were still there. So Jesus lifts up himself, and he saw none but the woman, meaning that none of the accusers, they had all bailed. So he's looking around, so where'd they go, right? And he said unto her, Woman, where are thine accusers? Hath no man condemned or judged thee? Because no man was found to bring accusation / witness against the woman, and she could have not been stoned for adultery, as thus saith the law, even if she was complicit in the facts. So we have a demonstration of here that when it comes to something like adultery, if this is authentic, then you have to have two witnesses to substantiate the stoning. I mean, that's what it says clearly, if this account is authentic. Without the witnesses of the mouth of one witness, there's no authenticity. There's no ability to convict and condemn to death. Okay, it's in the story itself. It's laid out there. It's intertwined with it, right? That's what the message is sending. Remember, I said this has to do with judgment, justice, and witnessing. So because no man was found to bring accusation of witness against the woman, then she could have not have been stoned for adultery, as thus saith the law, even if she was complicit in the act. We have no further look than King David with Bathsheba to illustrate this point. Now, on the other hand, what we have to deal with, too, is the fact that, is the very fact that this whole thing was fabricated. And that's been originally my thought all along. The woman was never caught in the act of adultery. Of course, there was never true witness. And all this thing was seen through right away, right? And that was my thought. It's been my thought for the longest time. And it makes sense. To me, at least, it makes sense. But anyway, continue reading. Could not have been stoned for adultery, as thus saith the law, even if she was complicit in the act. We have no further look than King David with Bathsheba to illustrate this point, because he committed adultery with Bathsheba. But because there was no witnesses to view what happened or to see what happened, it didn't fall into the context of the Torah. But it was still sin nonetheless, and David got judged for it, right? Yah took care of that. This further strengthens my belief that the scribes and Pharisees brought this woman to Jesus under false pretenses, and then Yahshua easily saw through their deceptive plan to ensnare him. Is it then possible the whole time that this woman was never actually caught in the act, that she had never committed adultery, and the whole thing was a grand scheme against Yahshua? And right up until this point, the 10th verse, that makes perfect sense. You can actually promote that and position yourself to say that's what this whole account was, if it's authentic, right? And you remember the Christians use this to show that all sins are going to be forgiven. It doesn't matter what you do after conversion, you can do it, and Yah is simply going to forgive you, and you go on a renewness of life. So they use this. All you got to do is read about it. They use this in the Kumbaya type of thought, where Yah is a Yah of justice. He doesn't change. He hates sin. He hates wickedness, and there's going to be a penalty for it. Okay, so verse 11, as we will soon read, raises concerns that she wasn't just a patsy and had not been caught in the very act, as Yahshua will tell this woman to go her way and sin no more. As Yahshua, what he's going to say to her. It is also entirely possible that this woman had in the past been involved in adulterous relationships, and the scribes and Pharisees decided to take advantage of this fact and claim she was actually caught in the act when in fact she hadn't. So I'm just examining a bunch of different possibilities, that's all. I'm not saying anything is, etched in stone. And whatever the direction that is put out here in the ministry, that's the direction we're going to use. Anyway, so, I made a side note here. And there was no mention of the woman's husband being not in attendance. I've heard that argument too. Actually, I heard a brother here speaking to another brother the other day about that. But where is that in Torah? You don't see that in Torah. Would the husband want to be there? There wasn't no call to go get the husband and bring him forth because your wife is going to get stoned. You just can't find it there. The only thing you ever find where the husband is directly involved is when you have the situation of the law of jealousy. And then, of course, he's there because the spirit of jealousy comes on him, and he feels like his wife has been up to no good. And so he, you can go back to Numbers 5 and read the whole program that covers that, and what happens with the end result, but that's really the only time you'll ever find out, you know, a husband being in a direct attendance when it's with a situation with adultery. Again, there's nothing in the Torah that reflects the fact that if a woman is found guilty of adultery, or a woman and a man, that the family members have to go get retrieved and be there first. Again, the law says the witnesses are first, and then next the people. And that part is clear. You can't dismiss that. That's actually clear, all right? So John chapter 8, verse 11. She said, "No man master, no man teacher." And Jesus said unto her, I mean, there's no man left there to condemn her, no man left to judge her, no man to bring witness against her. And Yahshua said unto her, "Neither do I condemn or judge thee. Go and sin no more." And again, we know that, and things come up in our head like, you know, the Son of Man has power to forgive on this earth. That was his own words. And which he did, and no doubt. His blood was perfect atonement for all things. And he has the complete and supreme authority to forgive that which he will. But he's going to hold those that are guilty to their guilt. Okay, here's the difficult issue. What did Jesus mean by go and sin no more? So this is the part of this whole account which, for me, raises more concerns than anything else. Because, first of all, if you bear in mind the theme of the whole thing, it's about this woman being forgiven for something. Well, all we know right then and there is the fact that she was supposedly caught in the act of adultery. So are we to believe that Jesus is actually, at that point, forgiving her for that sin of adultery? That doesn't seem to line up too well with Torah, right, at all. Because when you consider Torah, there was no possibility for atonement when it came to stoning. I mean, if somebody was caught in adultery, they were brought before the people and they were stoned to death. You don't read of anything for it. They didn't have no chance to make an atonement back then. There was no possibility. So again, and when he said go and sin no more, was just a blanket statement, you know? Woman, you got problems, and you just need go and sin no more, and, you know, you better start living a righteous life. Hebrews chapter 10, verses 28 and 29. He that despised Moses' law died without mercy under two or three witnesses. Okay, what did I skip here? Okay, all right, right. Okay, let me go back and read. This is important. Was he actually alluding here that she was indeed guilty of the sin of adultery and to not return to doing such sin again? Or was this simply a blanket statement of just that, go and sin no more? It does seem more certain that Jesus was addressing the issue that she was charged with being in adultery, but there is a huge piece of that is never mentioned, at least to my knowledge. If she had been forgiven for the sin of adultery, now listen closely, right? Now, this here, this is probably the one most difficult thing for me personally that makes this whole account so questionable, right? If she had been forgiven for the sin of adultery, then why did Jesus not state unequivocally, let's just throw aside everything else, right, that she could not return to her husband? What must never be forgotten in the place that witnesses have in judgment, especially whose transgressions which require death, that he that despised Moses' law, they died under mercy under two or three witnesses. We can't ever forget that. That's a big, playing a big part in all this. So I hope I didn't lose you there, but again, that one verse, verse 11, is that one there. I think if you go verses 1 through 10, you're good. But when you get to this one, we're about the forgiveness of sin, then you got a whole another ball game being opened up, especially in light of Torah. How can this be credible? Really, how can it be credible? Okay, but let's go on here. For me, this whole account, whether fiction or not, does raise more questions surrounding witnesses and their role in judging adultery and other sins which under Torah required death. And what of those which had done such dire transgressions, and there was no one to witness those acts, but acts that they did, but they of their own free accord confessed to the deed, and now the matter was made known. How does this self-confession of sin play a part when it comes to those things under Torah worthy of death. And no, it doesn't matter what it is. The Torah and the accounts we have in our Bible show that there was a sentence of death for murder, for kidnapping, for putting hands on parents, for cursing one's parents, for witchcraft, for divination, bestiality, the worship of other Elohims, the other gods, violating the Shabbat, for child sacrifice, for adultery, for incest, for sodomy, for whoredoms of a daughter of a priest, for someone of another tribe aiding or setting up or down taking down the tabernacle, someone of another tribe performing Levitical priestly duties, refusal to comply with a rendered judgment, giving false testimony when it involves a capital offense, rebellion against parents, a woman who claims she is a virgin upon marriage, then is found out that she lied about her virginity, and rape. Did every one of those things just listed always require two or more witnesses, or would self-confession also result in their deaths? I honestly don't know how to answer these questions, but I think they're good questions. I truly do. You know, you have situations where if we confess our sins, Yah is faithful and just to forgive us our sins. I don't know how that would tie into something in the Torah where it's a death sentence where there's no atonement. I truly don't. But again, we're trying to examine in the light of Torah if this kind of account, this whole account actually is valid or not. And the only way you can properly compare it, you can dismiss all the manuscripts and all the other theories out there and the early Christian writers and the what they call the church fathers. That stuff don't hold in the water. You have to do it in light of the word. Everything has to be measured by the word. I mean, if you look at an aside note here, you look and read Second Esdras, right? And in the Apocrypha, when I read that, we as far as I know, everybody in the ministry accepts that as actual doctrine, and it has the seal of the Holy Spirit on it. But there's some strange language in there that you just ain't going to see anywhere. And if you're not careful, your mind will start to challenge you. Well, how can this actually be ordered by the Most High? Because it seems so foreign, right? It seems so out of step, but yet nobody ever questions it, at least not that I know of. All right, we do have a few instances found in our Bibles how adultery was handled. Let me see. We do, however, have a few instances found in our Bibles how adultery was handled and was seemingly dealt with differently and the end result. One such account was the way in which Yahweh dealt with Israel in Jeremiah 3, how he identified their whoredoms and adultery, how he then put Israel away and gave them a bill of divorce, how he then extended mercy to Israel and spoke to them to return, and how he said that he was master over them. And I believe Pastor mentioned some back in the Sabbath mention that Yah actually instituted his own law for this particular situation right here. All right, yeah, and another thing, he always said he would be a husband over them or be married to them. That means to master over them. You know, return on me and I'll master over you. And I just have here in my note, if you ever do any study in Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4, talking about the laws of divorce and what it to give a woman a divorce, what's very interesting is that when you read the word husband in the first verse, it means master or to master over somebody. But when you read husband in the third verse, it's two different Hebrew words. It actually means man. So it's like the first woman that gets married is mastered, a woman that's mastered over, but then it comes to the other one she remarries. It's just simply a husband, not a master in that context. So that's very interesting why they choose two different Hebrew words for that particular four verses. Okay, then we also have the situation with David and Bathsheba, how David laid with the wife of another man, how Yahweh sent Nathan the prophet to expose their wickedness, how David witnessed the death of their newborn son, how David, as it is written in the Psalms, poured out his heart in repentance, and how the Bible records that David was covered or forgiven by Yah of all those transgressions he had committed, except the deed concerning the death of Uriah the Hittite, the husband of Bathsheba. And for whatever reason, in this particular case, the evil adultery was not put away from Israel. The only idea that I can offer as to why this was not fulfilled, meaning that they were subject to being stoned because of the Torah states again, and here it comes back again, that there must be two witnesses for something of the nature of capital crime to be fulfilled. And with the case of David, we do not have two witnesses. Hey, I mean, I'm just trying to use the word to reflect on something that's written and try to make sense of it because, but of course, it could be just Yah's mercy, right? I mean, we have to look at that too, whatever the case may be. And then we have an incident, and then we can turn the tables the other way and show that we're back completely in the Torah when you talk about what happened with Paul and Paul's writings in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. And I believe Pastor just covered that one too. And it was talking about the man that went and fornicated with his mother-in-law. Help me, Jesus, to remember. But he went and fornicated with his mother-in-law, and Paul was upset. You know, you're all puffed up. You ain't doing nothing. What the hell is wrong with you? Such and one, you need to put this man away. You need him to get him out of here. Obviously, that was a situation where it would have involved death, but, of course, they weren't doing that anymore. So, at least, I don't know why this incident was, but Paul just simply declared, you need to put this man away. Get him out of the midst. Get this evil out of Israel. This nasty stuff. We don't want this disease sitting around us, right? I mean, I'm being a little bit maybe too harsh about it, but I'm just trying to project what is in the mind that people really hate sin and hate wickedness and iniquity, right, and transgression. This stuff was vile, right? And, of course, Paul, being the righteous man he was, is like, you know, out of here. And we can see in there that they put this man away. They had nothing to do with him. Such an one not to eat, not to affiliate with, don't do nothing, right? You just leave him the hell alone, and there's nowhere you can ever prove that this man was ever restored back. You know, so what I'm saying is that there was really no forgiveness provided for him to make the ability to come back with the assembly. But then again, there are those that say that what is written in 2 Corinthians chapter 2 is a continuation of what happened to the man that was put out, and then in 2 Corinthians 2, they say that this same man, so he wouldn't be totally consumed in sorrow and overmuch buried in sorrow, that there was no coming back for him, even if it was possible, that basically Paul said, well, you let him come back, right? And so which one is it? I mean, but you can't prove that the two are connected. But it's two line of thoughts, and you have to take what's already written there and try to apply it whenever you're studying a subject. That's just the wise way to do it. I believe that if this is the fundamental question, forgiveness and reconciliation bond with the Torah commands. Okay, wait a second. Boy, I got so many notes on here. Holy crap. Let me see. I'm sorry, I've lost complete luck. All right, John chapter 8, verse 12, continues on. Okay, I don't know what happened there. But we've read 1 through 11. We have the whole entirety of the conversation. We know what has happened, what's transpired. And so now, again, like I said at the beginning of the study here, the mistake that a lot of people do when they're looking at this looking at this particular passage is they eliminate the 12th through the 18th verse, which to me, when I read it, it's all in context. It's all playing an integral part. It's all tied together in the situation that just happened. With the woman caught in the act of adultery. So it's going on. So in verse 12, so we have, if you get it, Jesus just spoke to the woman, everybody had left, all the false witnesses that turned and vacated, and they being convicted of their own conscience, talking about the scribes and Pharisees. So remember, there's still people gathering around there, right? And then spake Jesus again and said unto them, saying, I am the light of the world. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life. And I have to stop and reflect on this. That the reason that they say it stops at verse 11 is because, the reason they say because it says Jesus spake again unto them, saying, so he's talking about them. They always say, well, who's the them? Because everybody's already left. Well, that's not true. But the only people that The word says that left, that the verses we read before left were just the scribes and Pharisees. So I don't even know where they can conjure up some of this stuff. I really, truly don't. But there was still people there. The people didn't leave, just the ones that were convicted left, and that would be in the scribes and Pharisees. So again, Jesus has a crowd there, and he starts to say, and he's looking at them after the woman is probably still there, and I'm assuming she's still there, and all the people, and then he begins to speak again. And he says unto them, saying, I am the light of the world. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of light. In verse 13, John chapter 8, verse 13. The Pharisee therefore said unto him, thou bearest record of thyself. Thy record is not true. So we're continuing this thought. And now they're going back and they're going to try to destroy the credibility of Yahshua, because what they just, I mean, there had to be other Pharisees sitting around or other religious leaders, right? So now they're taking up where their comrades couldn't defeat Jesus, so now they're trying to take up their mantle and bring accusation against him and test his credibility. So the Pharisees said to him, thou bearest record of thyself, thy record is not true. And if you look behind the word record, it's the Greek 3140, and it means to be a witness, that is to testify. So what the scribes and Pharisees are saying, that you bear testify of yourself, you bear witness of yourself, right? So again, this still falls in line with the whole thing that has to do with witness. And as we read, we'll see how this story develops. Again, they were starting to attack Jesus, right? They were going to try to discredit him. And Jesus answered and said unto them, though I bear record of myself, I testimony of myself, yet my record is true, for I know whence I came and whither I go, but you cannot tell from whence I came, come, and whither I go. And he says in verse 15, you judge after the flesh, I judge no man. So now we're coming back. Now, what is this? Okay, the word judge means to decide. All right, distinguish, to distinguish a matter, to decide a matter. So you judge it. What happened to the woman? They meant to judge her. They meant to decide a matter. So the Greek 29:19 judge means to distinguish, that is decide, or by implication to try. And the word condemn. Okay, the word judge, I am sorry, the Greek 29:19 means to distinguish, decide, by implication to try. It means to condemn. That's where I was getting from. All right, Brother Ugly's got up there if you're on the chat room, all right? So it means to condemn. That's the word I'm looking for. It means to punish, to avenge, to conclude, to condemn, damn. Remember, they were trying to condemn this woman. Jesus said, where are thine accusers? And are there none that condemn thee? And she said, no, master, none. And he said, neither do I condemn thee, or neither do I judge thee. All right, go thy way and sin no more. So we have this whole situation where all this judgment's coming out. All right, in John 7:24, Jesus had made a statement that if one is to judge, that they judge not according to appearance, but judge righteous judgment, which in Yahshua's case meant judging after the thoughts and the intents of man's heart, as he had judged, just as he had judged the situation, the adulterous woman, and the men which had brought her before Messiah, and found these men to be liars and deceivers. And if you read John 7:24, it just simply says that judge not according to appearance, but judge righteous judgment. So going on with John chapter 8, we're going to go down to the 18th verse. We're in verse 16. But Jesus said, yet if I judge, my judgment is true, for I am not alone, but I and the Father that is sent me. It is also written in your law that the testimony of two men is true. I am the one that bear witness of myself, and the Father that sent me beareth witness of me. So when I read this together in context, Yahshua is basically telling that I was able to judge that situation and alleviate it by my personal judgment. And, if we believe the story, that he forgave the woman, right? But he already made it known to them, because they're saying, well, you know, you're not righteous. Your judgment isn't righteous. Your witness, you're actually
saying it's just you. So how can you have any type of testimony and witness if it's just you singular? Then Jesus goes on to prove to them that it's more than just me. It's me and the Father. So that is two witnesses, right? So anyway, all right. We're about done here. Now I'm going to skip ahead here a little bit. I'm just going to jump to John 8, chapter 8, verse 59, and it simply says to prove that Jesus was in the temple, that this was all one event. At the conclusion of where he goes with the rounds with the Pharisees, and they say that he's a fornicator, and Jesus tells them he's the father of the devil. If you read the entire chapter of John, chapter 8, it says at the end of it, then he went out of the temple. And you remember when the whole situation started that he went into the temple. That's why I said it's important in the beginning, all right? All right, I have a bunch of conclusions here, and I think I already covered most of them through the thing there when we talked about this. Number one, that remember this whole thing was trying to establish the authenticity of this in light of Torah. And again, I can't say for certain whether it does have authenticity because some of it is suspect to Torah, but other stuff lines up perfectly with Torah. The fact of the matter is, if you conclude that this whole thing was about false judgment and false witness, then it's easy to see that the story has credibility. But when you start bringing into question the fact that this woman that was supposed to suffer the death sentence under the law and according to the Torah, I got to read this last one. Okay, let me read this first. In light of the Torah as it pertains to death sentence, there was clearly no ability for transgressors to make atonement, as upon the proceedings, and they being found guilty were immediately stoned to death that Israel might put sin out of the camp. As there was no ability to provide atonement under the Torah, then how can we assume that atonement can be made today? How can we say that the blood of Jesus would deliver these transgressors from their death sentence? Because if it wasn't then, how can it be today? It's obvious that we no longer can stone the perpetrators to death, so the only recourse is to put them out of Israel as though they were dead, as dead men have no opportunity to repent. As the grace and forgiveness of Yah have been withheld from those who have committed such offenses worthy of death in this day and age with no hope of redemption. I don't know how to answer that question. And how would we apply this to the large list of other transgressions that merit death? The death sentence. Remember I read all them a while back ago? I mean, that big old list. And they are also without recourse for redemption. To bring these things into question in regards to John 8 would offer a suggestion that the whole of the account is a fabrication. So, again, the study of this after, and I'm sorry, but I'm not going to say whether it's authentic or not. You can do your own homework. But, again, you can lean one way and say that it is by saying the whole thing, like Pastor said, it's just that it was a big setup job, and they were trying to just, you know, deceive Jesus. And you just kind of look over the part of he forgive her. Maybe he didn't forgive her for adultery. Maybe it's just sin in general. We don't know. But if that was the case, then it adds a whole new challenge to this thing. It really, truly does. Because, again, if you were in ancient Israel and you were stoned to death, there was no atonement. You couldn't atone for yourself. You couldn't go out and offer a bullock or anything else for a sin offering because you was dead, right? So there is a lot there to think about. But anyway, I'll leave it with that while it's going on 7:30. But I hope you enjoyed it. I'm sorry if it was really heavy stuff or if it was maybe, a little bit confusing because there was a lot there, a lot of thought behind it. And if anybody has any questions, I'll do my best to try to answer them. I'm sure a lot of you may have your own thoughts about this too, but anytime that you read anything in the Word, you have to do your due diligence compared to what's already there because that's the only answer, just answer you're going to get. And then when you get that answer, you have to be able to properly discern and interpret what's being said. Because a lot of times, we develop a thought, we see something, read something, and all of a sudden something jumps in our mind and we start to go a different way with it than other what's actually written. And that can be dangerous too. So that's why it's important not just to jump the gun and start spewing stuff out there and start putting stuff out there like it's complete truth because you had some type of epiphany that this has got to be gospel truth and some type of deep revelation. But anyway, if anything, I hope this brought some nuances to this whole account. You know, some more things to consider, to think about. That's my whole point. It's not to say yay or nay. That's not my place. You know, we have a body of leadership that takes care of them questions and charts the course this ministry is going to go. So anyway, all right, with that, hey, y'all have a blessed week. Make sure you definitely lift up our shepherds, Pastor Dow, Pastor Corey, the leadership, the elders, the deacons, the teachers, and, of course, pray for one another. I mean, absolutely lift up one another. That is of the greatest, most importance, that we fight in the spirit, fight in our prayers, because we definitely know that we are in a war. So y'all have a blessed week. I don't know if it's going to be 4 weeks I'm going to be back or five, but anyway, blessings to y'all. You have a great rest of the night and great rest of the week. Much shalom.